Welcome to Greatness, where the world's leading thinkers share their ideas about how to create greatness, great leaders, great teams, and great organizations. Why be good when you can be great? This is Gretchen Gagle, and I am so excited to welcome Mike Staun to the Greatness Podcast today. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you, Gretchen, and I'm excited to be here as well.
Yeah, so Mike and I have known each other for quite some time through my two versions of my career in the construction industry in the U.S. Mike just recently retired from Procter & Gamble after an illustrious 36-year career there. And I had the opportunity to work closely with Mike around how do you create great teams and great leaders when it comes to construction execution, and would love to have you talk to us about that. But first, Mike, how did you end up at Procter & Gamble to begin with? How did that career get launched?
Yeah, well, I got a chance to work for a few large companies. I worked for a construction company here in Cincinnati called Messer. Worked for General Electric one summer, Aircraft Engine Group, which was also located just out of Cincinnati. And then I got a chance to work for Procter & Gamble also for a summer. And for the most part, it was based on that experience. I decided to start with P&G. How I got started, like a lot of people right out of school, P&G, you know, usually recruits directly. And it's, at least in my generation, it wasn't uncommon for people to have a very long career with P&G.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, I got recruited out of engineering school to run a dog food plant in Oklahoma, and that started my travels around the country as well. But that was the typical thing. You know, you went to, I feel very grateful for the wonderful training that I received with Ralston Purina.
Yeah, a very good company.
So I had a really interesting conversation with you probably 3 or 4 years ago. You made what I perceived to be a very brave decision at P&G, and I knew that you were, you know, within 5 years of your retirement, to really push your team to think differently about how construction was delivered at P&G. And sometimes when people get to the end of their career, they think, okay, I'm just going to kind of ride this out and, you know, ride off into the sunset and not make any waves. And you took a very different route. You said, nope, we're really going to do work in a different way. Tell me a little bit about how that came about.
Yeah, so when I first came into my role, I was responsible, the role which I went into, I was responsible for all of P&G's capital management. So P&G spends about $3.5 billion a year on new plants and equipment and processes to support our manufacturing operations. And so we had taken a very traditional approach as far as how we would did our project delivery methods. And that was a form of design, bid, build, which is known as EPCM. And that acronym stands for engineering, procurement, and then construction management. So we had actually put together, you know, a strategy, which we said, we're going to go ahead and go with two pretty large firms, Fluor as well as M&W, to do any of our big projects. And they'll do this EPCM work. They'll do the engineering, then they'll procure all the services and everything else and all the other folks that are needed to be able to deliver the project. And then they'll also serve as the construction manager. When I first came into that role, we had been doing that approach for about 5 years. And so I was asked to renew that strategy. And so before I renewed it, I decided, you know, better to find out how well it's working. And so I went around the world, talked to a number of P&G people. I talked to a number of Fluor people, a number of people from M&W, as well as some of the other trade partners that were brought in to be able to deliver those projects. And it was pretty universal that nobody liked that approach. It just wasn't working. You know, we weren't happy. They weren't happy. We had projects that were late. We had projects that were over budget. And we almost always had litigation afterwards. There'd be some kind of claims or threatening of claims with those projects. And so when I was looking around, I'd had some experience with lean in manufacturing. When I started with the company, Dr. Deming was just getting popular as far as in the U.S. He had already made quite a bit of intervention in Japan. And finally, people in the U.S. realized that if they didn't start listening to Dr. Deming and some of the other people behind the total quality movement, we were just going to be left behind. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be able to manufacture stuff. Having had that experience, I was like, you know, I'm hearing a little bit about lean being applied to project delivery. We as a company have been very successful in using lean in manufacturing. Why can't we use it in project delivery? And so that's kind of how I got my start with it.
Yeah. I want to point out something that one of the things that I really learned quite a bit about in my PhD on leadership is this kind of concept of boots on the ground and listening. And so it really sounds like that listening tour that you did around the world really informed setting the strategy for the overall program. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So in lean terms, actually one of the words that they use in Japan is Gemba, you know, it's go to the work. And so, you know, literally going around the world and talking to the project teams, being at the sites, walking around the sites, learning what went well and what didn't go well. And in so many cases, it was because you had different parties seeing things differently. People did not have the same goals. They didn't have the same motivations as far as what needed to be done. As I later learned, you know, part of that was because when everybody has just a contract with one other person, whether it's Procter & Gamble and having a contract with, let's say, Fluor to deliver some work, and then Fluor is going to have a whole bunch of contracts out with other people, all those contracts are two-party contracts. And it's very difficult to kind of get all those contracts aligned. What typically happens is people start to optimize around that contract, which ends up sub-optimizing that piece and end up sub-optimizing the whole project. So that was one of the things that I think as I got a chance to talk to people and learn people, it was just seeing how the misalignment that was out there. And the word that, you know, hit home to me was people said, well, this is just a fragmented industry. I was like, you're right. It is a fragmented industry. So if we're going to fix this industry, we've got to figure out a way to integrate the industry, or at least integrate it for the project that we're doing. You know, we may not be able to, you know, consolidate the industry, but at least on my project, I want to see one team working on one project with one goal in mind. I mean, that's what needs to be important for us.
How did you get people to open up to you? Because, you know, this whole concept around psychological safety, and it's, I just actually interviewed Amy Edmondson at Harvard, who's been writing about it for 20 years. It's become more popular term with the Google Aristotle project around effective teams. But how did you get people to really open up to you as a new leader in this position, wanting to learn about these issues?
For the most part, it's just asking questions, right? And asking and being open yourself. You have to realize, you know, that one of the terms that I heard early on was, you know, the only good contractor is the one you're not, that doesn't work for you, you know, that's not working for you. And so, you know, everybody is going to have faults, going to have issues. Things aren't always going to be perfect. But you can still, you know, if you bring people together and you work as one, usually you can get what you need to get done. And so I think that's one of the things, being open yourself and being vulnerable is one of the ways you get people to open up.
I love that word, vulnerable. It's too bad we don't teach that in engineering school, right? How to be vulnerable as a leader. So you collected this information and then in a very collaborative way with your team, but you were very, what's the word I'm looking for? Not directive, but you were clear in how the team was going to adopt lean practices. How did that go over in the beginning when you said, okay, I've kind of gathered the information and here's the direction that I'm setting as the leader of what we're going to implement? What was the reaction of your team?
I think some people thought I was hijacking our capital management leadership team, even though I was the leader of it. You know, that for years and years, this capital management leadership team, which included representatives from all of our business units, there are people who were really responsible for the capital management in their various businesses, were part of this team. And there was a few people that directly reported to me. For example, Jeff Wolf was our global process owner for construction management. And then we had a person who was our global process owner for cost engineering. We had a person who did that for a project. So we had a small sort of a, you know, what we called our capital management leadership team, a small group that reported directly directly to me. But most of the people that were going to be needed to really make this transformation, to make this move, were people who were in their businesses. They didn't report directly to me. So, you know, for the most part, I had to be in an influence mode. And so I can remember, you know, as a leader of this team, this is, some people say it's a loose confederation, right? But it was really a matter of working with those people and saying, hey, there's a better way to do this. And it took a while, but, you know, the key thing was, you know, continuing to go back and this is how we want to work versus this is how we're currently working. And then getting people to, you know, say, okay, we're willing to take a chance with this. Let's go ahead and do a pilot project here. And then you get a pilot, another pilot project, and you get another pilot. Finally, you build up a little bit of momentum and you have success. And of course, success breeds success.
I just taught a course at the Australian National University on thought leadership, which was a really interesting course because when you think about thought leadership, and that's really, in a way, Mike, what you were providing thought leadership around how to do capital program delivery in a different way. But many times you are influencing, you don't have the title, you don't have the ability to just say, this is the way we're going to do things, which really doesn't work that often anyway. So you talked about you just providing the evidence and going back and having that conversation and then having those quick wins and building some momentum. So what were some of those early wins that you had?
Yeah, one of the first pilot projects we had was in Greensboro. And we actually had a project manager that had never managed the project before. He was pretty strong technically. He had worked for me before. So I thought, you know, he was the right, you know, he had the right skill set to be successful as a project manager, but he had never actually managed a large project before. And the one thing that, you know, this is Andy Sivaking, who I'm referring to. And to Andy's credit, you know, the one thing that he quickly learned is he said, I've learned that I have to leave my ego at the door. You know, I know a lot about our equipment. I know a lot about the processes we use. I know how to make stuff. But, you know, this project management stuff is new to me. And so I really need to learn from other people. And I think that was the right approach for going in and actually leading our first pilot project for Lean IPD.
Great. And how did that project go?
It went very well. We really learned a lot. You know, one of the funnier things was the plant was somewhat hesitant to go ahead and do this pilot project. In fact, Mike Jennings was the construction manager at the Greensboro plant. And literally, you know, we had done all this work to set up our first collaborative design session where we were going to kick this approach off. We had invited not only the engineering folks, but the GC and a number of the trade partners. And it was going to be a large group that was going to convene for a total of 3 days to really kick things off and get it moving forward. And Mike Jennings was the construction manager of the plant. And he called me a good week before. He said, you know, I really don't want to do this. He said, I've got so much going on at this plant right now. The last thing I need to be doing is some pilot project, you know. So I said, Mike, I said, just bear with us. You know, let's go ahead and at least have the collaborative design session. We'll do these 3 days. At the end of those 3 days, if you truly believe that, you know, we're not going in the right direction, then we'll talk and we can do something different. So what was pretty amazing is then 2 days before we're supposed to do this, he sends out an email and it says, hey, we're already $400,000 over budget because we're paying for all these people to come to this collaborative design session. So we're bringing people in early, we're paying for them, and it's already killing my budget. Needless to say, I wasn't really excited about that, but I decided not to even respond. So
right.
We had the CDS, and literally the second day, Mike gives me a call and he says, hey, he says, I was all wrong about this. He said, we've already figured out how to save, you know, $500,000. I said, really? He said, how'd that work out? He said, well, he said, that HVAC guy that we probably wouldn't have included this early in the game, you know, pointed out that we'd be better off doing multiple units versus this one large unit. And with that, you know, we're going to have less duct work. We're going to have less problems. We won't need a second crane, on and on and on. Net, we're going to save $500,000 on just that alone. So I think this Lean IPD thing's going to work. The other thing he said is he had an epiphany. And so that's a big word for Mike. Okay. He said that as he was in the back of the room during this collaborative design session, he was just looking around and he said, you know, he wasn't talking to anybody, but he could see everybody was sort of in smaller groups talking. and discussing and collaborating, you know, figuring out how they were going to get this work done. It dawned on him that, you know, no longer was he needed to be the conduit for all the information flow that was going back and forth. And so he actually figured that, okay, on this particular project, it might take less effort on his part, because now that you've got people talking to each other versus always having to go through him, it's probably going to be easier on him.
What great insights. I think one of the other important things that you did, Mike, are the firm that I was president of in the U.S. Continuum Advisory Group was one of the organizations that you brought in, because people said, I don't know how to do lean IPD. You know, I don't know what this looks like. And talk a little bit about that. Like, how did you help them figure out how to do this?
I think the one thing is, you show it's really not that dissimilar to maybe other stuff that we've done. And so if you look at a collaborative design session, that's actually one of our seven essential practices that we do for lean IPD. And, you know, the closest thing to that was what we would have is called a good old fashioned project kickoff. And all I said is, hey, just think of this CDS is a kickoff on steroids. You know, what we're going to do is include more people, and we're going to include people that normally don't get brought in till later. We're going to bring them in early, and we're going to start working together to go ahead and figure out how we're going to do this project. So a lot of terms people use is validation phase. And so with this process, you do a validation phase. And the only way you can really do that is if you include all the people that are really needed up front in that phase. And it certainly helped. You know, one of the things that Kelsey Henderson, who works with you, Gretchen, she was able to, as a facilitator, kind of, you know, how do you bring people in from different parts and get them working together? And what we have found is, if people have a problem that they can, now it's a mutual problem, they pretty naturally work together. You know, all of a sudden, if you come into a room that people have been working on a problem, you really can't tell who's from what firm. Mm-hmm. They're all kind of coming at it different ways, but they're all kind of working together to find a solution. So I think, you know, real problems, you know, are one of the best ways to unite people and integrate people to work together.
Yeah, that actually leads into my next question, Mike, because IPD, integrated project delivery and integration, you know, I've talked to people. I have a slide I use about the spectrum of collaboration to integration. And collaboration and integration, in my mind, are two different things. Collaborate is, we're just kind of going to be nice to each other, right? And collaboratively think about the team. But integration does reach that level of, you can't tell who's on what team. What are some of the ways that you build up the trust necessary to have those integrated conversations about these problems?
Yeah, so I think that trust, I mean, in fact, one of the things that we use is the one TED talk on psychological safety by Amy Edmondson. It's actually, you know, a common thing that we'll go ahead and share with the team early on, because what's so important about that is you need people to be willing to open up. Now, just showing them a TED talk isn't going to automatically open them up, right?
Right.
But it is starting to say, this is what's expected. You know, we're expecting that people, if you've got an idea, that you're bringing it up. If you've got a concern, you're bringing it up. And we know that the only way we're going to be successful on this project is if we can go ahead and collaborate to the point where we're truly innovating. Because right now, we don't have a solution. We don't have a solution that either fits our budget or a solution that fits our timing or other parameters that are out there. And so we try to challenge our teams to the point where they see that, hey, you know, we just can't, this isn't a walk in the park, right? We've got to do something different. We've got to figure out something. You know, we're going to need to work together to be able to do that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it is focused on business results. When I started doing partnering sessions back in 1994, is what this kind of collaboration was called way back in the dark ages of the beginning of my consulting career. And people are like, oh, it's just being nice to one another and singing Kumbaya and everything. And it's like, no, it's about hitting budget and schedule. And the very first session that I ever sat in on, that we worked with your organization on, we eliminated 4 months of schedule on a 13-month project in an afternoon using pole planning.
That was in Box Shelter, right? And mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was, again, a very successful pilot project that really helped that particular business see the value of doing this approach And so the next time a project came up, in fact, the next project right at that Box Elder plant, they also did a very similar type of approach.
What new skills, if any, did you find that your project managers and your teams out there needed to learn? I mean, obviously showing the Amy Edmondson TED Talk on psychological safety and thinking about how to create that. But did you have any other things that your project managers, you went, oh, they're really not equipped either through their education or their experience to operate in this kind of new methodology?
Yeah, I would say as far as are very specific as the whole pull planning. So people can do pull planning, but then there's also taking it to that level where you're actually using the Last Planner system. Last Planner requires you to do pull planning, but you can do pull planning and not be doing Last Planner. There's more to it. There's actually five conversations that need to be taking place to be able to successfully do Last Planner. And so I think that's one where, you know, even on some of the projects that went well, you know, we were really just doing pull planning. We really didn't get that team to where they were fully taking advantage of all five conversations. And mm-hmm. So I see that as an opportunity, but I also see that as, you know, that's something that you just don't get people out of school naturally familiar with being able to do that process.
So interesting. I gave a speech at the either Construction User Roundtable, I believe it was, on a study we did, and we utilized some of the Dodge data on their study on lean practices, and that it really showed, looking at, I think, 160, 180 projects, that deeply lean construction projects, I think it's 2 times as likely to be on budget and 3 times as likely to be on schedule. And yet the Lean Construction Institute, how many years ago, and you sit on their board in the United States, they were created, what, almost 30 years ago?
Yeah, so that's probably when people first started to get together and started to say, okay, we're seeing lean and manufacturing. How can we start to apply it to project delivery? And so this year, just this past month ago, we had LCI, the Lean Construction Industry, had their 21st annual Congress. And so think mm-hmm. about that. They've been actually having a established Congress. Now, the first one, there's probably only 50 people there. This year, we had 1,700 people in Fort Worth, Texas, for LCI's Congress. So it's continued to grow. But in the grand scheme of things, if you look at if you did a bell curve, for example, of all the construction projects, and let's just pick the United States, which is a fairly developed market, you would still see just a small percentage of that bell curve, just the tip of that, would be doing things that you would say is truly following lean construction practices.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you talk to a site and you said, hey, are you guys doing lean? Every construction site would probably say, yeah, we're doing lean. And yet they have no clue what they're doing as far as lean.
Right. Well, I've managed to track down the Lean Construction Institute here in Australia. They're interested in me potentially starting a chapter here in Canberra in the ACT. There is no chapter here, but I'm on the bandwagon over here. I'm lobbying in a proposal to speak at the Australian Pipeline and Gas Association about lean practices. So I think there's an opportunity here in Australia as well. So I'd love to talk to my guests about what they're reading. And before we started recording, you actually told me about a couple of books. And now that I've recovered from my PhD and I've actually started reading again, I'm starting to collect ideas from people. But the one that you mentioned I thought was really interesting, Mike, Essentialism?
Yeah, Essentialism. Greg McEwen is the author of that book. And he gave the keynote for LCI. This year on the first day. And essentialism and lean are really closely related, because obviously what lean's trying to do is, what's the most important thing? How do you get rid of waste? And so one of the best ways to get rid of waste is to really identify what's important, and everything else often is waste. But that's a great read. So it was really helpful, not only I think for the people in the audience, but me personally, because at this point in my life, if anything, I've got to figure out what are the small number, and I'm talking probably 2 or 3 things that I'm really going to put my efforts against.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't want to do at this point in my life is to have my efforts scattered across a bunch of stuff and really not have much of an impact on anything. So that was a really good read for me, but I would encourage anybody who, any point in their career, to pick that one up and read it.
Great. Well, I'm at that stage of my life also, trying to make decisions about different opportunities. And so I'm definitely going to be picking up that book. And Mike, I just want to thank you. I think that people being able to speak openly about things that have been tried with huge success in organizations, lean IPD, integrated project delivery. And I, you know, starting in the 80s in manufacturing, as I did as well, with Deming and TQM and so many lessons to learn about how we create truly integrated construction project teams that are all focused on the same goals and the wins and have these amazing results when it comes to schedule and budget. Thank you so much, Mike, for coming on Greatness today and sharing your thoughts with us.
Well, thank you, Gretchen, for having me.
Interested in hearing more? Visit us at greatnessconsulting.com. Thank you.